Looks like a stamp. The
Senate will convene as a court of impeachment. The chaplain will offer a prayer.
And this is Chaplain, the Reverend Dr. Lloyd Ogilvie.
Almighty God, whose providential care has never varied all through our nation's history, we ask you for a special measure of wisdom for the women and men of this Senate as they act as jurors in this impeachment trial. You have been our nation's refuge and strength in triumphs and troubles, prosperity and problems. Now, dear Father, help us through this difficult time. As you guided the senators to unity in matters of procedure, continue to make them one in their search for the truth and in their expression of justice. Keep them focused in a spirit of nonpartisan patriotism today and in the crucial days to come. Bless the distinguished Chief Justice as he presides over this trial. We commit to you all that is said and done, and ultimately decided. In your holy name, amen.
Now Justice Rehnquist takes his seat. He is, of course, the Chief Justice of the United States.
The Sergeant-at-Arms will make the proclamation.
Sergeant-at-Arms is James Ziegler.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons are commanded to keep silent on pain of imprisonment while the Senate of the United States is sitting for the trial of the Articles of Impeachment exhibited by the House of Representatives against William Jefferson Clinton, President of the United States.
That the same announcement
the
made during the trial of Andrew Johnson.
Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Trent Lott, the Senate Majority Leader, Republican of Mississippi.
Providing for appropriated equipment and furniture in the Senate chamber, and ask that it be agreed to and the motion to reconsider be laid upon the table.
The clerk will report the resolution by title.
Senate Resolution 17 to authorize the institution.
And this is a procedural motion to permit the installation of, I believe, the television monitors that the House managers are going to be using.
Mr. Chief Justice, I now ask unanimous consent that the four privileges be granted to the individuals listed on the document I send to the desk during the closed impeachment proceedings of William Jefferson Clinton, President of the United States.
Without objection, it's so ordered.
Mr. Chief Justice, I ask unanimous consent that the Secretary of the Senate be authorized to print as a Senate document all documents filed by the parties together with other materials for the convenience of all senators.
Without objection, it is so ordered.
Mr. Chief Justice, I'm about to submit a series of unanimous consent agreements and a resolution for the consideration of the Senate. In addition to these matters, I would like to state for the information of all senators that pursuant to Senate Resolution 16, the evidentiary record on which the party's presentations over the next days will be based was filed by the House managers yesterday and was distributed to all senators through their offices. These materials are now being printed at the government printing office as Senate documents. The initial documents of the record have been printed and are now at each senator's desk. As the printing of the rest of the volumes of the record is completed over the next few days, they will also be placed on the senator's desk for their convenience.
Without objection, the journal of the proceedings of the trial are approved to date. The presiding officer submits to the Senate for printing in the Senate journal the following documents. The precept issued on January 8, 1999. The writ of summons issued on January 8, 1999. And the receipt of summons dated January 8, 1999. The presiding officer submits to the Senate for printing in the Senate journal the following documents which were received by the Secretary of the Senate pursuant to Senate Resolution 16.
This is an official acknowledgement that the various materials required for this trial have been properly summoned and properly received and are now being entered into the record of this trial. the Chief Justice is reading these documents as provided to him, I assume, by the parliamentarian, so that the form is kept. It's a curiosity of this proceeding, which is peculiar in many respects, that the Chief Justice of the United States is acting as you might expect the President Pro Tem of the Senate normally to act, who's normally presiding in that chair, and normally referred to as Mr. President, the President of the Senate. In this case, there is a procedure that has been established where he will be referred to. Everybody has agreed to this. Again, the Senate operates under rules of unanimity, or and that is that he will be referred to as Mr. Chief Justice and for the purposes that we're going to be hearing over the next several days.
The Senate and the parties in this case of my need to stand on occasion to stretch my back. I have no intention that the proceedings should be any way interrupted when I do so. The presiding officer notes the presence in the Senate chamber of the managers on the part of the House of Representatives and counsel for the President of the United States. Pursuant to the provisions of Senate Resolution 16, the managers for the House of Representatives have 24 hours to make presentation of their case. The Senate will now hear you. The presiding officer recognizes Mr. Manager Hyde to begin the presentation of the case for the House of Representatives.
Henry Hyde, Republican of Illinois, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, nods to the Chief Justice
and
stands at the lectern.
President and senators, we are brought together on this solemn and historic occasion to perform important duties assigned to us by the Constitution. We want you to know how much we respect you and this institution, and how grateful we are for your guidance and your cooperation. With your permission, we, the managers of the House, are here to set forth the evidence in support of two articles of impeachment against President William Jefferson Clinton. You are seated in this historic chamber not to embark on some great legislative debate, which these stately walls have so often witnessed, but to listen to the evidence as those who must sit in judgment. To guide you in this grave duty, you've taken an oath of impartiality. With the simple words, "I do," you have pledged to put aside personal bias and partisan interest and to do impartial justice. Your willingness to take up this calling has once again reminded the world of the unique brilliance of America's constitutional system of government. We are here, Mr. Chief Justice and distinguished senators, as advocates for the rule of law, for equal justice under the law, and for the sanctity of the oath. The oath. In many ways, the case you will consider in the coming days is about those two words, "I do," pronounced at two presidential inaugurations by a person whose spoken words have singular importance to our nation and to the great globe itself. More than 450 years ago, Sir Thomas More, former Lord Chancellor of England, was imprisoned in the Tower of London because he had, in the name of conscience, defied the absolute power of the king. As the playwright Robert Bull tells it, More was visited by his family, who tried to persuade him to speak the words of the oath that would save his life, even while in his mind and heart he held firm to his conviction that the king was in error. More refused. As he told his daughter Margaret, "When a man takes an oath, Meg, he's holding his own self in his hands, like water, and if he opens his fingers then, he needn't hope to find himself again." Sir Thomas More, the most brilliant lawyer of his generation, a scholar with an international reputation, the center of a warm and affectionate family life, went to his death rather
than take an oath in vain. Members of the Senate, what you do over the next few weeks will forever affect the meaning of those two words, "I do." You are now stewards of the oath. Its significance in public service and our cherished system of justice will never be the same after this. Depending on what you decide, it will either be strengthened in its power to achieve justice, or it will go the way of so much of our moral infrastructure and become a mere convention full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. The House of Representatives has named myself and 12 other members as managers of its case. I have the honor of introducing those distinguished members and explaining how we will make our initial presentation. The gentleman from Wisconsin, Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, will begin the presentation with an overview of the case. Representative Sensenbrenner is the ranking Republican member of the House Judiciary Committee and has served for 20 years. In 1989, Representative Sensenbrenner was a House manager in the impeachment trial of Judge Walter L. Nixon, who was convicted on two articles of impeachment for making false and misleading statements before a federal grand jury. Following Representative Sensenbrenner will be a team of managers who will make a presentation of the relevant facts of the case. From the very outset of this ordeal, there's been a great deal of speculation and misinformation about the facts. That has been unfortunate for everyone involved. We believe a full presentation of the facts and the law by House managers will be helpful. Representative Ed Bryant from Tennessee was a United States attorney from the Western District of Tennessee. As a captain in the Army, Representative Bryant served in the Judge Advocate General Corps and taught at the United States Military Academy at West Point. Representative Bryant will explain the background of events that led to the illegal actions of the President. Following Representative Bryant, Representative Asa Hutchinson from Arkansas will give a presentation of the factual basis for Article 2, obstruction of justice. Representative Hutchinson is a former United States attorney for the Western District of Arkansas. Next, you will hear from Representative Jim Rogan of California. Representative Rogan is a former California state judge and Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney. Representative Rogan will give a presentation of the factual basis for Article 1, grand jury perjury. This should conclude our presentation for today. Tomorrow, Representative Bill McCollum of Florida will tie all of the facts together and give a factual summation. Representative McCollum is chairman of the Subcommittee on Crime, a former Naval Reserve commander and member of the Judge Advocate General Corps. Following the presentation of the facts, a team of managers will present the law of perjury and the law of obstruction of justice and how it applies to the articles of impeachment before you today. While the Senate has made it clear that a crime is not essential to impeachment and removal from office, these managers will explain how egregious and criminal the conduct alleged in the articles of impeachment is. This team includes Representative George Gekas of Pennsylvania, Representative Steve Chabot of Ohio, Representative Bob Barr of Georgia, and Representative Chris Cannon of Utah. Representative Gekas is the chairman of the Subcommittee on Commercial and Administrative Law. And in 1989, he served as a manager of the impeachment trial of Judge Alcee Hastings, who the Senate convicted on eight articles for making false and misleading statements under oath, and one article of conspiracy to engage in bribery. Representative Gekas is a former assistant district attorney. Representative Chabot serves on the Subcommittee on Crime and has experience as a criminal defense lawyer. Representative Barr is a former United States attorney for the Northern District of Georgia, where he specialized in public corruption. He also has experience as a criminal defense attorney. Representative Cannon has had experience as the Deputy Associate Solicitor General of the Department of the Interior and as a practicing attorney. That should conclude our presentation for Friday. On Saturday, three managers will make a presentation on constitutional law as it relates to this case. There's been a great deal of argument about whether the conduct alleged in these articles rises to the level of removable offenses. This team's analysis of the precedents of the Senate and application of the facts of this case will make it clear that the Senate has established the conduct alleged in the articles to be removable offenses. In this presentation, you will hear from Representative Charles Kennedy of Florida, Representative Steve Buyer of Indiana, and Representative Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Representative Kennedy is chairman of the Subcommittee on the Constitution and one of the leading voices on constitutional law in the House. Representative Buyer served in the United States Army as a member of the Judge Advocate General Corps, where he was assigned as special assistant to the United States Attorney in Virginia. He also served as a deputy to the Indiana Attorney General. Representative Graham served in the Air Force as a member of the Judge Advocate General Corps and as a South Carolina assistant attorney. Following the presentation of the facts, the law of perjury and obstruction of justice and constitutional law, Mr. Rogan and myself will give you a final summation and closing to our initial presentation. Mr. Sensenbrenner.
Recognized.
Mr. Chief Justice, distinguished counsel to the President and Senators. In his third annual message to Congress on December 7, 1903, President Theodore Roosevelt said, quote, "No man is above the law and no man is below it. Nor do we ask any man's permission when we require him to obey it. Obedience to the law is demanded as a right, not asked as a favor," unquote. We are here today because President William Jefferson Clinton decided to put himself above the law, not once, not twice, but repeatedly. He put himself above the law when he engaged in a multifaceted scheme to obstruct justice during the federal civil rights case of Paula Corbin Jones versus William Jefferson Clinton et al. He put himself above the law when he made perjurious, false, and misleading statements under oath during his grand jury testimony on August 17, 1998. In both instances, he unlawfully attempted to prevent the judicial branch of government, a co-equal branch, from performing its constitutional duty to administer equal justice under law. The United States House of Representatives has determined that the President's false and misleading testimony to the grand jury and his obstruction of justice in the Jones lawsuit are high crimes and misdemeanors within the meaning of the Constitution. Should the Senate conduct a fair and impartial trial which allows each side to present its best case, then the American public can be confident that justice has been served regardless of the outcome. We hear much about how important the rule of law is to our nation and our system of government. Some have commented this expression is trite, but whether expressed by these three words or others, the primacy of law over the rule of individuals is what distinguishes the United States from most other countries and why our Constitution is as alive today as it was 210 years ago. The framers of the Constitution devised an elaborate system of checks and balances to ensure our liberties by making sure that no person, institution, or branch of government became so powerful that a tyranny could ever be established in the United States of America. We are the trustees of that sacred legacy, and whether the rule of law and faith in our nation emerges stronger than ever or are diminished irreparably depends upon the collective decision of the message each senator chooses to send forth in the days ahead. The evidence you will hear relates solely to the President's misconduct, which is contrary to his constitutional public responsibility to ensure the laws be faithfully executed. It is not about the President's affair with a subordinate employee, an affair that was both inappropriate and immoral. Mr. Clinton has recognized that this relationship was wrong. I give him credit for that. But he has not owned up to the false testimony, the stonewalling, and legal hair splitting, and obstructing the courts from finding the truth. In doing so, he has turned his affair into a public wrong. And for these actions, he must be held accountable through the only constitutional means the country has available: the difficult and painful process of impeachment. Impeachment is one of the checks the framers gave to Congress to protect the American people from a corrupt or tyrannical executive or judicial branch of government. Because the procedure is cumbersome, and because a two-thirds vote in the Senate is required to remove an official following an impeachment trial, safeguards are there to stop Congress from increasing its powers at the expense of the other two branches. The process is long. It is difficult. It is unpleasant. But above all, it is necessary to maintain the public's trust in the conduct of their elected officials such as myself and yourselves, who through our oaths of office have a duty to follow the law, fulfill our constitutional responsibilities, and protect our republic from public wrongdoing. The framers of the Constitution envisioned a separate and distinct process in the House and in the Senate. They did not expect the House and the Senate to conduct virtually identical proceedings, with the only difference being that conviction in the Senate requires a two-thirds vote. That is why the Constitution reserves the sole power of impeachment to the House of Representatives and the sole power to try all impeachments to the Senate. History demonstrates different processes were adopted to reflect very different roles. In the case of President Andrew Johnson, no hearings were held or witnesses called by the House on the President's decision to remove Secretary of War Stanton from office. The House first approved a general article of impeachment that simply stated that President Johnson was impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. 5 days later, a special House committee drew up specific articles. 11 articles were passed by the House, all but two of which were based upon President Johnson's alleged violation of the Tenure of Office Act by his actions in removing Secretary of War Stanton. The trial was then conducted with witnesses in the Senate. In the case of President Nixon, the House Judiciary Committee passed three articles of impeachment based not upon their own investigation, but upon the evidence gathered by the Irvin Committee, the Patman Committee, the Joint Tax Committee, and material from the special prosecutor in various court proceedings. Nine witnesses were called at the end of the impeachment inquiry, five of them at the request of the White House, and their testimony was not at the center of the impeachment articles. In the Judge Walter Nixon impeachment in 1989, a trial with live witnesses was held even after the Senate rejected, by less than a two-thirds vote, a defense motion to dismiss one article of impeachment on the grounds that it did not constitute an impeachable offense. The House managers submit witnesses are essential to give heightened credence to whatever judgment the Senate chooses to make on each of the articles of impeachment against President Clinton. The matter of how this proceeding will be conducted remains somewhat unsettled. Senate impeachment precedent has been to hold a trial, and in every impeachment case, the Senate has heard from live witnesses. Should the President's counsel dispute the facts as laid out by the House of Representatives, the Senate will need to hear from live witnesses in order to reach a proper and fair judgment as to the truthful facts of this case. The House concluded the President made perjurious, false, and misleading statements before the grand jury, which the House believes constitutes a high crime and misdemeanor. Our entire legal system is based upon the courts being able to find the truth. That's why witnesses must raise their right hand and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That's why there are criminal penalties for perjury and making false statements under oath. The need for obtaining truthful testimony in court is so important that the federal sentencing guidelines have the same penalties for perjury as for bribery. The Constitution specifically names bribery as an impeachable offense. Perjury is the twin brother of bribery. By making the penalty for perjury the same as that for bribery, Congress has acknowledged that both crimes are equally serious. It follows that perjury and making false statements under oath, which is a form of perjury, be considered among the high crimes and misdemeanors the framers intended to be grounds for impeachment. The three judicial impeachments of the 1980s were all about lies told by a federal judge. Judge Claiborne was removed from office for lying on his income tax returns. Judge Hastings was removed for lying under oath during a trial. And Judge Nixon was removed for making false statements under oath to a grand jury. In each case, the Senate showed no leniency to judges who lie. Their misconduct was deemed impeachable, and more than two-thirds of the Senate voted to convict them. If the Senate is convinced that President Clinton lied under oath and does not remove him from office, the wrong message is given to our courts, those who have business before them, and to the country as a whole. That terrible message is that we as a nation have set a lower standard for lying under oath for presidents than for judges. Should not the leader of our country be held to at least as high a standard as the judges he appoints? Should not the president be obliged to tell the truth when under oath, just as every citizen must? Should not our laws be enforced equally? Your decision in this proceeding will answer these questions and set the standard of conduct of public officials in town halls and courtrooms everywhere and the Oval Office for generations. Justice is never served by the placing of any public official above the law. The framers rejected the British law of the king can do no wrong when they wrote our basic law in 1787. Any law is only as good as its enforcement, and the enforcement of the law against the president was left to Congress through the impeachment process. A Senate conviction of the president in this matter will reaffirm the irrefutable fact that even the president of the United States has no license to lie under oath. Deceiving the courts is an offense against the public. It prevents the courts from administering justice and citizens from receiving justice. Every American has a right to go to court for redress of wrongs, as well as the right to a jury trial. The jury finds the facts. The citizens on the jury cannot correctly find the facts absent truthful testimony. That's why it's vital that the Senate protect the sanctity of the oath to obtain truthful testimony, not just during judicial proceedings, but also during legislative proceedings as well. Witnesses before the Congress, whether presidential nominees seeking Senate confirmation to high posts in the executive or judicial branches, federal agency heads testifying during investigative hearings, or witnesses at legislative hearings giving their opinions on bills, are sworn to tell the truth. Eroding the oath to tell the truth means that Congress loses some of its ability to base its decisions upon truthful testimony. Lowering the standard of truthfulness of sworn testimony will create a cancer that will keep the legislative branch from discharging its constitutional functions as well. Mr. Chief Justice, we are here today because William Jefferson Clinton decided to use all means possible, both legal and illegal, to subvert the truth about his conduct relevant to the federal civil rights suit brought against him by Mrs. Paula Jones. Defendants in civil lawsuits cannot pick and choose which laws and rules of procedure they follow and which they will not. That's for the trial judge to decide whether the defendant be president or pauper. In this case, a citizen claimed her civil rights were violated when she refused then-Governor Clinton's advances and was subsequently harassed at work, denied merit pay raises, and finally forced to quit. The court ruled she had the right to obtain evidence showing other women, including Ms. Lewinsky, got jobs, promotions, and raises after submitting to Mr. Clinton, and whether other women suffered job detriments after refusing similar advances. When someone lies about an affair and tries to hide the facts, they violate the trust their spouse and their family put in them. But when they lie about it during legal proceedings and obstruct the parties from obtaining evidence, they prevent the courts from administering justice. That is an offense against the public, made even worse when a poor and powerless person seeks the protection of our civil rights laws from the rich or powerful. When an American citizen claims his or her civil rights have been violated, we must take those claims seriously. Our civil rights laws have remade our society for the better. The law gives the same protections to the child denied entry to a school or college based upon race as to an employee claiming discrimination at work. Once the hole is punched in civil rights protections for some, those protections are not worth as much for all. Many in this Senate have spent their lives advancing individual rights. Their successful efforts have made America a better place. In my opinion, this is no time to abandon that struggle, no matter what the political mood and no matter what the political consequence. Some have said that the false testimony given by the president relating to sex should be excused, since, as the argument goes, everyone lies about sex. I would ask the Senate to stop and think about the consequences of adopting that attitude. Our sexual harassment laws would become unenforceable, since every sexual harassment suit is about sex. And much of the domestic violence litigation in our country is at least partly about sex. If defendants in these types of suits are allowed to lie about sex, justice cannot be done, and many victims, mostly women, will be denied justice. Mr. Chief Justice, the House has adopted two articles of impeachment against President William Jefferson Clinton. Each meets the standard of high crimes and misdemeanors, and each is amply supported by the evidence. Article 1 impeaches the president for perjurious, false, and misleading testimony during his August 17, 1998 appearance before a grand jury of the United States in four areas. First, the nature and details of his relationship with a subordinate government employee. Second, prior perjurious, false, and misleading testimony he gave in a federal civil rights action brought against him. Third, prior false and misleading statements he allowed his attorney to make to a federal judge in that federal civil rights lawsuit. Fourth, his corrupt efforts to influence the testimony of witnesses and to impede the discovery of evidence in that federal civil rights action. The evidence will clearly show that President Clinton's false testimony to the grand jury was not a single or isolated instance which could be excused as a mistake, but rather a comprehensive and calculated plan to prevent the grand jury from getting the accurate testimony in order to do its job. Furthermore, it is important to dispel the notion that the president's false testimony before the grand jury simply relates to the details of the relationship between President Clinton and Ms. Lewinsky. These charges make up only a small part of Article 1. The fact is, the evidence will show that President Clinton made numerous perjurious, false, and misleading statements regarding his efforts to obstruct justice. Before describing what the evidence in support of Article 1 shows, it is also important to clearly demonstrate that the Senate has already decided that making false statements under oath to a federal grand jury is an impeachable offense. The last impeachment decided by the Senate, that of United States District Judge Walter L. Nixon, Jr. of the United States District Court for the Southern District of Mississippi, involved the judges making false statements under oath to a federal grand jury. Precisely the same charges contained in Article 1 against President Clinton. Following a unanimous 417-0 vote in the House, the Senate conducted a full trial and removed Judge Nixon from office on the two articles charging false statements to a grand jury by votes of 89-8 and 78-19. The Senate was clear that the specific misconduct, that is, making false statements to a grand jury, which was the basis for the judge's impeachment, warranted his removal from office, and the Senate proceeded to do just that. These votes, a little more than 9 years ago on November 3, 1989, set a clear standard that lying to a grand jury is grounds for removal from office. To set a different standard in this trial is to say that the standard for judicial truthfulness during grand jury testimony is higher than that of presidential truthfulness. That result would be absurd. The truth is the truth, and a lie is a lie. There cannot be different levels of truth for judges than for presidents. The president's perjurious, false, and misleading statements regarding his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky began early in his grand jury testimony. These statements included parts of the prepared statement the president read at the beginning of the testimony. He referred or reverted to this statement at least 19 times during the course of the testimony. Further, the evidence will show the president made other false statements to the grand jury regarding the nature and details of his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky at times when he did not refer to his prepared statement. Second, the evidence will show that the president piled perjury upon perjury when he provided perjurious, false, and misleading statement testimony to the grand jury concerning prior perjurious, false, and misleading testimony given in Mrs. Paula Jones' case. On two occasions, the president testified to the grand jury that his deposition testimony was the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and that he was required to give a complete answer to each question asked of him during the deposition. That means he brought to the grand jury his untruthful answers to questions at the deposition. Third, the evidence will show the president provided a perjurious, false, and misleading testimony to a federal grand jury regarding his attorney's use of an affidavit he knew to be false during the deposition in Mrs. Paula Jones' case before federal judge Susan Weber Wright. The president denied that he even paid attention to Mr. Bennett's use of the affidavit. The evidence will show he made this denial because his failure to stop his attorney from utilizing a false affidavit at a deposition would constitute an obstruction of justice. The evidence will also show the president did not admit that Mr. Bennett's statement was false because to do so would be to admit that he had perjured himself earlier that day during the grand jury testimony as well as at the deposition. Fourth, the evidence will show that the president provided perjurious, false, and misleading testimony to the grand jury concerning his corrupt efforts to influence the testimony of witnesses and to impede the discovery of evidence in Mrs. Paula Jones' civil rights action. The evidence will show that these statements related to at least four areas. First, his statements relating to gifts exchanged between the president and Ms. Lewinsky. The subpoena served on Ms. Lewinsky in the Jones case required her to produce each and every gift she had received from the president. These gifts were not turned over as required by the subpoena, but ended up under Ms. Betty Curry's bed in a sealed container. The president denied under oath that he directed Ms. Curry to get the gifts, but the evidence will show that Ms. Curry did call Ms. Lewinsky about them, and that there was no reason for her doing so unless directed by the president. Second, the president made perjurious, false, and misleading statements to the grand jury regarding his knowledge that the Lewinsky affidavit submitted at the deposition was untrue. The evidence will show that the president testified falsely on this issue on at least three separate occasions during his grand jury testimony. He also provided false testimony on whether he encouraged Ms. Lewinsky to file a false affidavit. Third, the president made false and misleading statements to the grand jury by reciting a false account of the facts regarding his interactions with Ms. Lewinsky and Ms. Curry, who is a potential witness against him in Mrs. Jones' case. The record reflects the president tried to coach Ms. Curry to recite inaccurate answers to possible questions should she be called as a witness. The evidence will show the president testified to the grand jury that he was trying to figure out what the facts were, but in reality, the conversation with Ms. Curry consisted of a number of very false and misleading statements. Finally, the president made perjurious, false, and misleading statements to aides regarding his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky. In his grand jury testimony, the president tried to have it both ways on this issue. He testified that his statements to aides were both true and misleading. true, and misleading. The evidence will show that he met with four aides who would later be called to testify before the grand jury. They included Mr. Sidney Blumenthal, Mr. John Podesta, Mr. Erskine Bowles, and Mr. Harold Ickes. Each of them related to the grand jury the untruths they had been told by the president. I have recited this long catalog of false statements to show that the president's false statements to the grand jury were neither few in number nor isolated, but rather pervaded his entire testimony. There can be no question that the president's false statements to the grand jury were material to the subject of the inquiry. Grand juries are utilized to obtain sworn testimony from witnesses to determine whether a crime has been committed. The Attorney General and the Special Division of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit appointed an independent counsel pursuant to law and added areas of inquiry because they believe that there was evidence that the president may have committed crimes. Grand jury testimony relevant to the criminal probe is always material to the issue of materiality, whether someone has committed a crime. Based upon the precedent in the Judge Nixon impeachment, the law, the facts, and the evidence, if you find the president made perjurious, false, and misleading statements under oath to the grand jury, I respectfully submit that your duty will be to find William Jefferson Clinton guilty with respect to Article 1 and to remove him from office. Article 2 impeaches William Jefferson Clinton for preventing, obstructing, and impeding the administration of justice in Mrs. Paula Jones' case by either directly or through subordinates and agents engaging in a scheme to delay, impede, cover up, and conceal the existence of evidence and testimony relating to Mrs. Jones' federal civil rights action. As in the case of Article 1, the president's direct and indirect actions were not isolated mistakes, but were multifaceted actions specifically designed to prevent Mrs. Paula Jones from having her day in court. While the Senate determined in the Judge Nixon trial that the making of false statements to a federal grand jury warranted conviction and removal from office, no impeachment on an obstruction of justice charge has ever reached the Senate. Therefore, this article is a matter of first impression. However, the impeachment inquiry of the House Judiciary Committee into the conduct of President Richard Nixon, as well as the relevant federal criminal statutes, clearly show President Clinton's actions to be within the definition of high crimes and misdemeanors contained in the Constitution. The first article of impeachment against President Nixon, approved by the Judiciary Committee, charged Mr. Nixon with, quote, engaging personally and through his subordinates and agents in a course of conduct or plan designed to delay, impede, and obstruct the investigation of such unlawful entry, to cover up, conceal, and protect those responsible, and to conceal the existence and scope of other unlawful activities, unquote. The article charged that the implementation of the plan included nine separate areas of misconduct. Included among these were, one, making or causing to be made false and misleading statements to investigative officers and employees of the United States. Two, withholding relevant and material evidence from such persons. Three, approving, condoning, acquiescing in, and counseling witnesses with respect to the giving of false and misleading statements to such persons, as well as in judicial and congressional proceedings. History shows us that President Nixon's resignation was the only act that prevented the Senate from voting on this article, and that the president's conviction and removal from office were all but certain. There are two sections of the Federal Criminal Code placing penalties on those who obstruct justice. Title 18, United States Code, Section 1503 punishes, quote, whoever corruptly or by threats or force obstructs or impedes or endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede the due administration of justice, unquote. The courts have held that this section relates to pending judicial process, which can be a civil action. Mrs. Jones' case fits that definition at the time of the President's actions as alleged in Article 2, as does the Office of Independent Counsel investigation. Title 18, United States Code, Section 1512 punishes, quote, whoever corruptly persuades another person or attempts to do so or engages in misleading conduct toward another person with intent to influence, delay, or prevent the testimony of any person in an official proceeding, or cause or induce any person to withhold testimony or withhold a record, document, or other object from an official proceeding, unquote. The evidence will show that President Clinton's actions constituted obstruction of justice in seven specific instances as alleged in Article 2. Paragraph 1 alleges that on or about December 17, 1997, the President encouraged Ms. Lewinsky, who would be subpoenaed as a witness in Ms. Jones' case 2 days later, to execute a sworn affidavit he knew would be perjurious, false, and misleading. The evidence will show the President's actions violated both federal criminal obstruction statutes. Second, Article 2 alleges that on or about that same day, the President corruptly encouraged Ms. Lewinsky to give perjurious, false, and misleading testimony if and when called to testify personally in that proceeding. Ms. Lewinsky, on the witness list at that time, could have been expected to be required to give live testimony in the Jones case, and in fact, she was subsequently subpoenaed for a deposition in that case. The evidence will show the President's actions violated both federal criminal obstruction statutes. Third, Article 2 alleges that on or about December 28, 1997, the President corruptly engaged in, encouraged, or supported a scheme to conceal evidence which had been subpoenaed in Mrs. Jones' civil rights case. He did so by asking Ms. Betty Curry to retrieve evidence from Ms. Lewinsky that had been subpoenaed in the case of Jones versus Clinton. The evidence will show the President's actions violated the second federal criminal obstruction statute. Fourth, Article 2 alleges that beginning on or about December 7, 1997, and continuing through and including January 14, 1998, the President intensified and succeeded in an effort to secure job assistance to Ms. Lewinsky in order to corruptly prevent her truthful testimony in the Jones case at a time when her truthful testimony would have been harmful to him. While Ms. Lewinsky had sought employment in New York City long before the dates in question, helping her find a suitable job was clearly a low priority for the President and his associates until it became obvious she would become a witness in the Jones case. The evidence will clearly show an intensification of that effort after her name appeared on the witness list. This effort was ultimately successful, and the evidence will show that the President's actions violated both federal obstruction statutes. Fifth, Article 2 alleges that on January 17, 1998, the President corruptly allowed his attorney to make false and misleading statements to Judge Wright, characterizing the Lewinsky affidavit in order to prevent questioning deemed relevant by the judge. The President's attorney, Robert Bennett, subsequently acknowledged such false and misleading statements in a communication to Judge Wright. The evidence will show the President's actions clearly violated the second federal criminal obstruction statute. Sixth, Article 2 alleges that on or about January 18th, 20th, and 21st, 1998, the President related a false and misleading account of events relevant to Mrs. Jones' civil rights suit to Ms. Betty Curry, a potential witness in the proceeding, in order to corruptly influence her testimony. The evidence will show that President Clinton attempted to influence the testimony of Ms. Betty Curry, his personal secretary, by coaching her to recite inaccurate answers to possible questions that might be asked of her if called to testify in Ms. Paula Jones's case. The President did this shortly after he had been deposed in the criminal action. in the civil action. During the deposition, he frequently referred to Ms. Curry, and it was logical that based upon his testimony, Ms. Curry would be called as a witness. The evidence will show that 2 hours after the completion of the deposition, the President called Ms. Curry to ask her to come to the office the next day, which was a Sunday. When Ms. Curry testified to the grand jury, she acknowledged that the President made a series of leading statements or questions and concluded that the President wanted her to agree with him. The evidence will show that the President's actions violated both statutes, but most particularly Section 1512. In United States versus Rodolitz, the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit said, quote, "The most obvious example of a Section 1512 violation may be the situation where a defendant tells a potential witness a false story as if the story were true, intending that the witness believe the story and testify to it before the grand jury," unquote. If the President's actions do not fit this example, I am at a loss to know what actions do. Seventh and last, Article 2 alleges that on or about January 21st, 23rd, and 26th, 1998, the President made false and misleading statements to potential witnesses in a federal grand jury proceeding in order to corruptly influence the testimony of those witnesses. The article further alleges these false and misleading statements were repeated by the witnesses to the grand jury, causing the grand jury to receive false and misleading information. The evidence will show these statements were made to presidential aides Mr. Sidney Blumenthal, Mr. Erskine Bowles, Mr. John Podesta, and Mr. Harold Ickes. They all testified to the grand jury. By his own admission, 7 months later, on August 17, 1998, during his sworn grand jury testimony, the President said that he told a number of aides that he did not have an affair with Ms. Lewinsky and did not have sex with her. He told one aide, Mr. Sidney Blumenthal, that Ms. Monica Lewinsky came on to him and that he rebuffed her. President Clinton also admitted that he knew those aides might be called before the grand jury as witnesses. The evidence will show they were called, they related the President's false statements to the grand jury, and that by the time the President made his admission to the grand jury, the damage had already been done. This is a classic violation of Title 18 United States Code, Section 1512. The seven specific allegations of obstruction of justice contained in Article 2 were designed to prevent the judicial branch of government, a separate and co-equal branch, from doing its work in Mrs. Paula Jones' lawsuit. Based upon the allegation of Article 1 against President Nixon in 1974, as well as the repeated and calculated violations of two key criminal obstruction statutes, William Jefferson Clinton committed an impeachable offense. In Article 2, the evidence is conclusive that President Clinton put himself above the law in obstructing justice, not once, not just a few times, but as a part of an extensive scheme to prevent Mrs. Jones from obtaining the evidence she thought she needed to prove her civil rights claims. Complying with the law is the duty of all parties to lawsuits and those who are required to give truthful testimony. A defendant in a federal civil rights action does not have the luxury to choose what evidence the court may consider. He or she must abide by the law and abide by the rules of procedure. William Jefferson Clinton tried to say that the law did not apply to him during his term of office as far as civil cases were concerned. He properly lost that argument in the United States Supreme Court in a unanimous decision. Even though the Supreme Court decided that the President wasn't above the law and that Mrs. Jones' case could proceed, William Jefferson Clinton decided, and decided alone, to act as if the Supreme Court had never acted and that Judge Wright's orders didn't apply to him. What he did was criminal time and time again. These criminal acts were in direct conflict with the President's obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Based upon the repeated violations of federal criminal law, its effect upon the courts to find the truth, and the President's duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, if you find that the President did indeed obstruct the administration of justice through his acts, I respectfully submit that your duty will be to find William Jefferson Clinton guilty with respect to Article 2 and to remove him from office. It is truly sad when the leader of the greatest nation in the world gets caught up in a series of events where one appropriate and criminal act leads to another and another and another. Even sadder is that the President himself could have stopped this process simply by telling the truth and accepting the consequences of his prior mistakes. At least six times since December 17, 1997, William Jefferson Clinton could have told the truth and suffered the consequences. Instead, he chose lies, perjury, and deception. He could have told the truth when he first learned that Miss Lewinsky would be a witness in Mrs. Jones' case. He could have told the truth at his civil deposition. He could have told the truth to Betty Curry. He could have told the truth when the news media first broke the story of his affair. He could have told the truth to his aides and cabinet. He could have told the truth to the American people. Instead, he shook his finger at each and every American and said, "I want you to listen to me," and proceeded to tell a straight-faced lie to the American people. Finally, he had one more opportunity to tell the truth. He could have told the truth to the grand jury. Had he told the truth last January, there would have been no independent counsel investigation of this matter, no grand jury appearance, no impeachment inquiry, and no House approval of articles of impeachment. And we would not be here today fulfilling a painful and essential constitutional duty. Instead, he chose lies, despite warnings from friends, aides, and members of the House and Senate that failure to tell the truth would have grave consequences. When the case against him was being heard by the House Judiciary Committee, he sent his lawyers, who did not present any new evidence or rebut the facts and evidence sent to the House by the independent counsel. Rather, they disputed the committee's interpretation of the evidence by relying on tortured, convoluted, and unreasonable interpretations of the President's words and actions. During his presentation to the House Judiciary Committee, the President's very able lawyer, Charles Ruff, was asked directly, "Did the President lie during his sworn grand jury testimony?" Mr. Ruff could have answered that question directly, but he did not, and his failure to do so speaks a thousand words. Is there not something sacred when a witness in a judicial proceeding raises his or her right hand and swears before God and the public to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Do we want to tell the country that its leader gets a pass when he is required to give testimony under oath? Should we not be concerned about the effect of allowing perjurious, false, and misleading statements by the President to go unpunished on the truthfulness of anyone's testimony in future judicial and legislative proceedings? And what do we tell the approximately 115 people now in federal prison for the crime of perjury? The answers to all these questions ought to be obvious. As elected officials, our opinions are frequently shaped by constituents telling us their own story. Let me tell you one related to me about the poisonous results of allowing false statements under oath to go unpunished. Last October, when the Starr report was being hotly debated, one circuit court judge for Dodge County, Wisconsin, approached me on the street in Mayville, Wisconsin. He said that some citizens had business in his court and suggested that one of them take the witness stand and be put under oath to tell the truth. The citizen then asked the judge if he could tell the truth, just like the President. How many people who have come to court to testify under oath about matters they would like to keep to themselves think about what that citizen asked Judge John Stork? And how will the courts be able to administer the equal justice under law we all hold so dear if we do not enforce the sanctity of that oath, even against the President of the United States? When each of us is elected or chosen to serve in public office, we make a compact with the people of the United States of America to conduct ourselves in an honorable manner, hopefully setting a higher standard for ourselves than we expect of others. That should mean we are careful to obey all the laws we make, execute, and interpret. There is more than truth in the words, a public office is a public trust. When someone breaks that trust, he or she must be held accountable and suffer the consequences for the breach. If there is no accountability, that means that a president can set himself above the law for 4 years, a senator for 6, a representative for 2, and a judge for life. That, Mr. Chief Justice, poses a far greater threat to the liberties guaranteed to the American people by the Constitution than anything imaginable. For the past 11 months, the toughest questions I've had to answer come from parents who want to know what to tell their children about what President Clinton did. Every parent tries to teach their children to know the difference between right and wrong, to always tell the truth, and when they make mistakes, to take responsibility for them and to face the consequences of their actions. President Clinton's actions at every step since he knew Miss Lewinsky would be a witness in Mrs. Jones's case have been completely opposite to the values parents hope to teach their children. But being a poor example is not grounds for impeachment. Undermining the rule of law is. Frustrating the court's ability to administer justice turns private misconduct into an attack upon the ability of one of the three branches of our government to impartially administer justice. That is a direct attack upon the rule of law in our country and a very public wrong that goes to the constitutional workings of our government and its ability to protect the civil rights of even the weakest American. What is on trial here is the truth and the rule of law. Failure to bring President Clinton to account for his serial lying under oath and preventing the courts from administering equal justice under law will cause a cancer to be present in our society for generations. Those parents who have asked the question should be able to tell their children that even if you are the President of the United States, if you lie when sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, you will face the consequences of that action even when you will not accept the responsibility for it. How those parents answer those questions is up to the United States Senate. While how today's parents answer those questions is important, equally important is what parents tell their children in the generations to come about the history of our country and as what has set our government in the United States of America apart from the rest of the world. Above the President's dais in this Senate chamber appears our national motto, E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. When that motto was adopted more than 200 years ago, the first Congress referred to how 13 separate colonies turned themselves into one united nation. As the decades have gone by, that motto has taken an additional meaning. People of all nationalities, faiths, creeds, and values have come to our shores, shed their allegiances to their old countries, and achieved their dreams to become Americans. They came here to flee religious persecution, to escape corrupt, tyrannical, and oppressive governments, and to leave behind the economic stagnation and endless wars of their homelands. They came here to be able to practice their faiths as they saw fit, free of government dictates, and to be able to provide better lives for themselves and for their families by the sweat of their own brows and the use of their own intellect. But they also came here because they knew America has a system of government where the Constitution and laws protect individual liberties and human rights. Everyone, yes, everyone can argue that this country has been a beacon for the individual citizen's ability to but be what he or she can be. They fled countries where rulers ruled at the expense of the people to America, where the leaders are expected to govern for the benefit of the people. And throughout the years, America's leaders have tried to earn the trust of the American people, not by their words, but by their actions. America is a place where government exists by the consent of the governed. And that means our nation's leaders must earn and re-earn the trust of the people with everything they do. Whenever an elected official stumbles, that trust is eroded and public cynicism goes up. The more cynicism that exists about government, its institutions, and those chosen to serve in them, the more difficult the job is for those who are serving. And that's why it's important, yes, vital, that when a cancer exists in the body politic, our job, our duty is to excise it. If we fail in our duty, I fear the difficult and dedicated work done by thousands of honorable men and women elected to serve, not just here in Washington, but in our state capitals, city halls, courthouses, and school board rooms will be swept away in a sea of public cynicism. We must not allow the beacon of America to grow dim, or the American dream to disappear with each waking morning. In 1974, Congress did its painful duty when the President of the United States broke the public trust. During the last decade, both houses impeached and removed from office three federal judges who broke their trust with the people. During the last 10 years, the House of Representatives disciplined two speakers for breaking the rules and their trust with the public. And less than 6 years ago, this honorable Senate did the same thing to a senior senator whose accomplishments were widely praised. In each case, Congress did the right thing to help restore the vital trust upon which our government depends. It wasn't easy, nor was it always popular, but Congress did the right thing. Now this honorable Senate must do the right thing. It must listen to the evidence. It must determine whether William Jefferson Clinton repeatedly broke our criminal laws and thus broke his trust with the people. A trust contained in the presidential oath put into the Constitution by the framers. An oath that no other federal official must take. An oath to ensure that the laws be faithfully executed. How the Senate decides the issues to be presented in this trial will determine the legacy that we pass to future generations of Americans. The Senate can follow the legacy of those who made America what it is. The Senate can follow the legacy of those who put their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor on the line when they signed the Declaration of Independence. The Senate can follow the legacy of the framers of the Constitution, whose preamble states that one of its purposes is to establish justice. The Senate can follow the legacy of James Madison and the members of the first Congress, who wrote and passed the Bill of Rights to preserve the liberties of the American people. The Senate can follow the legacy of those who achieved equal rights for all Americans during the 1960s, in Congress, in the courts, on the streets, and in the buses, and at the lunch counters. The Senate can follow the legacy of those who brought President Nixon to justice during Watergate and the belief that no president can place himself above the law. The Senate can follow the legacy of Theodore Roosevelt, who lived and governed by the principle that no man is above the law. Within the walls of the Capitol and throughout this great country, there rages an impassioned and divisive debate over the future of this presidency. This Senate now finds itself in the midst of the tempest. An already immense and agonizing duty is made even more so because of the whims of public opinion polls, the popularity and unpopularity of individuals, even questions over the strength of our economy, risks assuming the true nature of this grave and unwelcome task. We have all anguished over the sequence of events that have led us to this, the conclusive stage of this process. We have all identified in our own minds where it could have and should have stopped. But we have ended up here before the Senate of the United States, where you, the senators, will have to render judgment based upon the facts. A scientist in search of the basic nature of a substance begins by boiling away what is not of the essence. Similarly, the Senate will sift through the layers of debris that shroud the truth. The residue of this painful and divisive process is bitter, even poisonous at times, but beneath it lies the answer. The evidence will show that at its core, the question over the president's guilt and the need for his conviction will be clear. Because at its core, the issues involved are basic questions of right versus wrong, deceptive criminal behavior versus honesty, integrity, and respect for the law. The president engaged in a conspiracy of crimes to prevent justice from being served. These are impeachable offenses for which the president should be convicted. Over the course of the days and weeks to come, we, the House managers, will endeavor to make this case. May these proceedings be fair and thorough. May they embody our highest capacity for truth and mutual respect. With these principles as our guides, we can begin with the full knowledge our democracy will prevail and our nation will emerge a stronger, better place. Our legacy now must be not to lose the trust of the people should have in our nation's leaders. Our legacy now must be not to cheapen the legacy left by our forebears. Our legacy must be to do the right thing based upon the evidence. And for the sake of our country, the Senate must not fail. Thank you.